Bank of America is one of the country's largest financial institutions. It's also facing a mountain of legal and financial troubles that are threatening its stability. In his latest article for Rolling Stone, contributing editor Matt Taibbi argues that the bank's situation has become dangerous to the health of the world's economy. Bank of America, too crooked to fail, appears in the April issue of the magazine. I'm pleased that it brings Matt Taibbi back to our show for today's backstory segment. Hello, welcome back.
Hello, good to see you.
You begin your article by calling Bank of America a hyper-gluttonous ward of the state whose limitless fraud and criminal conspiracies we'll all be paying for until the end of time. Strong words. Is Bank of America even worse than the other major banks?
I guess the way I would put it is it has all the problems of all the other too-big-to-fail companies, except that it seems to be, by volume, it gets into more trouble than the rest of them. It's in much worse shape than a lot of the other companies. For example, Goldman Sachs, which has plenty of troubles.
You've also gone after.
Sure, but it still has a credit rating that's far higher than Bank of America, which is now just two or three levels above junk. So Bank of America has a mountain of lawsuits that it's facing that far surpasses the other banks. So it's in more trouble than the other banks.
But it's also a huge bank. It's all over the country, isn't it?
Yeah, and it controls, I believe the last figures were somewhere between 11 and 12% of America's banking deposits. It has, according to one statistic, it controls about 17% of America's mortgages. So it's an enormous company.
And how does it compare with what it was during the 2008 financial crisis?
Well, it's...
Has it had to cut back?
No, and it's bigger. All of these companies are bigger than they were before the crash. Bank of America, in a move that was completely counterintuitive, during the crash and in the years before the crash, it made two enormous acquisitions. It acquired Merrill Lynch, which was a struggling, gigantic investment bank, and then it also acquired Countrywide, which was the world's largest subprime lender. Those two acquisitions should have actually torpedoed the company, but ironically, it put the bank into so much trouble that the government had to rescue it, and now it's even bigger than it was before.
So you believe that its sheer size protects the bank from any actual accountability? Is it even much bigger to fail? Does that affect the way that it conducts its business? Are they aware of the fact that no matter what happens, they're going to be protected by some kind of safety net?
I don't think that the bank's executives, wake up in the morning and say, "Hey, we're so big that nothing we do is gonna get us in trouble or put us out of business. So let's go and commit securities fraud." I don't think it's like that, but I think it does on some deeper level, on a psychological level within the management of the company. It inspires a kind of recklessness, and there's a lack of accountability that is pervasive. After a while, after you start engaging in practices that are unethical or unsavory and there's no consequences for it, it tends to make that more of a common occurrence.
You trace many of the problems with American banking today to Hugh McCall Jr. and Ed Crutchfield, two bankers in North Carolina, which is where Bank of America is based. What banks were they with when this whole thing started?
Yeah, McCall and Crutchfield were the CEOs, respectively, of First Union and Nations Bank, which were two competing North Carolina banks. These two men had a personal rivalry. Actually, well, these two banks had a longstanding rivalry, which was kind of humorously expressed in their continual efforts to build a bigger skyscraper than the other. In fact, McCall, when he finally built the Bank of America Tower, that is, I guess, was the fifth or sixth in a series of competing skyscrapers, when someone asked if he was happy that he had the biggest one, he said, "Yes, I prefer to have the taller one." So that kind of gets to the psychological
aspect. And it's been called the Taj Mahal.
The Taj Mahal, right, yeah. It's sort of a monstrosity that dots the Charlotte skyline there.
So their rivalry actually fueled their attempts to have banking laws changed.
Yes.
Was it kind of like teamwork, even though they were rivals?
I guess you could look at it that way. I mean, it's interesting the way it unfolded. Prior to the mid-'80s, the Bank Holding Company Act of 1956 essentially prevented any bank from expanding beyond the borders of one state.
And there was also the McFadden-Pepper Act of 1927,
right. And the purpose of these laws was to prevent sort of exactly the situation we have now, which is where there's an undue and dangerous concentration of capital. They just wanted banks to be regional and intrastate. But both of these guys wanted to have influence beyond their borders. So there was a Supreme Court decision in 1985. I think it was Bancorp v. Board of Governors, which allowed banks to expand within a designated geographical region beyond their borders. So you could cross state lines. But what was interesting about this was that it was a limited kind of competition. In other words, they could expand to other southern territories, but they were also protected from competition from the big banks in New York. So it allowed them to go on the shopping spree where they bought up 50, 60, 70 banks in the South, and that made them into these giant banking powers.
Although now the New York banks can go into the South as well.
Right, yeah. There was another change in the law in the early 90s that completely eliminated the ban on interstate banking, and now you have this national banking system.
Which is convenient if you have a bank card from a local bank and you wind up in some major city and you can just go to the bank and do a transaction, but it also has led to a lot of problems, as you point out. Is this what led McCall's bank to be renamed Bank of America?
Yeah, eventually they bought – it was a Nations Bank. They eventually bought the San Francisco-based bank, Bank of America. When they did that merger in the 90s, they decided to change their name to Bank of America.
He acquired 200 banks and thrifts, including Bank of America.
Right.
I guess he was looking to build a banking empire.
Right. Yeah, he said one of the key quotes with him is that he said that if he couldn't get out of just North Carolina, he couldn't be important. And so they wanted to be important. It wasn't so much about making money for shareholders necessarily, but they wanted to be a big banking power, and that's what they are.
And Crutchfield also did something similar. He wound up with Wachovia.
Right.
Which has had a more tragic story.
Sure, which ended up getting acquired by Wells Fargo. But the point being that both of these two tiny, initially tiny banks in North Carolina became too big to fail.
How were they able to finance all those takeovers?
Actually, I don't even know the answer to that question, but they did. They went on this shopping spree and they ended up with an enormous footprint all over the financial services industry, especially after McCall left Bank of America, and they made those two purchases of Countrywide and Merrill Lynch, because that left them in this monstrous position that they're in now.
And you compare the union of Bank of America, Countrywide Financial, and Merrill Lynch with the 1997 film Con Air.
Right.
What are the similarities?
Yeah, Con Air, which I mistakenly identified as a Michael Bay movie. It just looks like a Michael Bay movie. It was, this movie where you had, like, the worst redneck, the most evil serial killer, and the most destructive terrorist all in one plane. And that's kind of what the post-merger Bank of America was. You had the most reckless subprime lender in Countrywide. You had Merrill Lynch, which had become the trader in the most exotic kinds of derivative transactions. They were the kings of the subprime CDO in the mid-2000s. And then you had Bank of America, which was, a reckless agent of all its own. They were all under this one roof, and that created this groundswell of mortgage-based fraud, basically.
And wasn't Countrywide concerned about Bank of America's, quote, appetite for risky products? So Countrywide, which was pretty wild in itself, this is pretty ironic.
Yeah, this came out later. They found that that Angela Mozilla, the head of Countrywide, who was once named the worst CEO in American history, he's sort of widely considered to be the most reckless and unethical character to emerge from the entire financial crisis. Even Angela Mozilla was kind of freaked out by Bank of America's appetite for the subprime mortgages that his company was cranking out. There was an exchange of emails where he's saying to a subordinate, essentially, I can't believe they're buying this stuff. They just have an endless appetite for it.
Well, how much can we blame Bank of America and Countrywide for for selling these mortgages and financial products that help sink the economy?
Oh, we can blame them 100%.
Wasn't it industry-wide? Were they just doing what everybody else was doing?
I guess so, but they were doing more of it than anybody else, and they were probably, they couldn't possibly have been more reckless than they were. I think people, they misunderstand what happened during that whole period. It was really a fraud scheme where they were creating bad mortgages specifically to sell them to people who didn't know how bad they really were, and they were a high volume operator in that scam.
Was anyone in Washington or on the state level watching what was going on?
Not really. I mean, there are obviously various regulators, the OCC, the SEC, the FBI did warn back in the early 2000s that there was a problem with what they called liar's loans. In other words, when you apply for a mortgage, a liar's loan is a mortgage where you only have to state what your income is. You don't have to show proof of it. That's called a stated income loan or a liar's loan. The FBI warned that in the early 2000s that this was becoming a problem. By the mid-2000s, about half of all subprime loans were liar's loans, and nobody did more liar's loans than Countrywide. But regulators never followed up on that lead, and it became this gigantic mushrooming problem that ended up causing the 2008 crash.
And I remember after the crash, some people said, well, it was the fault of the liars because they were getting themselves in over their heads.
Well, yeah, and you know what? It on some level it was the fault of the liars, because when somebody comes to you and says, "Hey, you know, you make $7 an hour or you're unemployed, but we'd like to give you a $600,000 mortgage anyway." Sure, people have a responsibility to not do that. But a lot of people were simply uneducated. They believed what their brokers were telling them. Some people actually qualified for good loans and got bad loans anyway, bad and dangerous subprime loans. But ultimately, the real problem here was that this was a scam that made the banks a lot of money, and that was where the impetus was. It wasn't because people were going to Rutgers and lying. It was because the banks wanted them to take these loans out.
My guest is Rolling Stone contributing editor Matt Taibbi. His article, Bank of America, Too Crooked to Fail, appears in the April issue of that publication. Let's get to the bank's legal troubles. You write that Bank of America treats the law like its own personal urinal cake.
Yeah. What we've really tried to do in this article is show the whole range of things that these two big-to-fail companies get themselves involved with. And Bank of America is much like what we did with Goldman Sachs when we wanted to show what investment banks do. Bank of America is just a typical example of all the different things that this kind of company can do. And they have an enormous problem with securities fraud, with selling mismarked mortgages, misrepresenting to institutional investors what was in these pools of mortgages, bid rigging, trying to rig the LIBOR market, which is this enormous new scandal that's now coming out, mistreating homeowners, robo-signing. It's just an enormous array of criminal actions.
But haven't they been paying a price for it? In just the first half of last year, Bank of America paid out $12.7 billion to settle claims of people who said that they were defrauded. Are those settled? Well, what about those settlements?
Most people think that those settlements only represent a fraction of their actual obligations. Now, this is sort of an important point.
Is 12.7 a lot of money for Bank of America? $12.7 billion.
Sure, it is a lot of money for Bank of America, but it's not as much as they actually owe. Not even nearly. What people need to understand is when they put these pools of mortgages together, the part of their sales pitch when they went to go sell these things to pension funds or unions or foreign retirement funds, one of the things they said was, if any of these mortgages turn out to be defective, it's written right here in the contract that we'll buy them back. We'll repurchase those bad loans from you if they turn out not to be good. So they're contractually obligated to go back and buy these loans. But what ended up happening was people bought this stuff, the loans started failing, or they were already failed by the time they got them. And then when they called Bank of America to say, take this stuff back, they just wouldn't pick up the phone. And so just in terms of the repurchases, they owe billions and billions of dollars over and above that kind of money that they paid last year.
And isn't that what bankrupted the insurance giant Ambac in 2010?
Yeah, among other things, Ambac. A lot of these companies, they're called monoline insurers. They insure the insured mortgage bonds. There were also insurance companies that bought these mortgages as an investment. So a lot of these insurers ended up paying out claims on pools of mortgages that blew up. A lot of them also ended up holding pools of mortgages that went down in value. So you, all these companies, MBIA, AmBac, Allstate, AIG, they all suffered massive, massive losses because of these things.
And they all seem to be suing the bank, not just AmBac, Allstate, AIG, but the states of Iowa, Oregon, Maine, the United Methodist Church, Dallas County in Texas, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and many of the homeowners who were looking to get loan modifications. I'm probably missing a few things.
Oh, yeah. No, when I was doing the story, I actually had to make this gigantic poster and color code it with magic markers where, you know, pink represented state pension funds and yellow represented homeowners. There's so many of these lawsuits that it's really hard to keep track of.
It's also been sued for conspiring to rig the London interbank offered rate. What's that?
This is a truly incredible story that has somehow gone under the radar. It's only starting to surface in the last year or so. Most adjustable rate investments, including things like adjustable rate mortgages, are based on the London Interbank Exchange Rate, which is called LIBOR. So if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, it'll be based on – and what LIBOR is the rate at which banks lend to each other. Okay, so every day the banks will report to a board how much they're charging each other to lend each other money. Well, what the banks have been doing is they've been getting together – colluding in cartel-like fashion.
This is Barclays Bank, mostly in England.
It's all of them. It's UBS, it's Bank of America, it's Barclays. It's basically all the usual suspects. They've been getting together, and they've been saying, "Let's tell the board that we're charging each other less. That it actually costs less for us to borrow money from each other." So LIBOR becomes artificially low, and what ends up happening is that anybody who owns an adjustable rate investment instrument ends up getting less from the banks. So all of these municipalities that invest in various adjustable rate instruments, they're getting paid less from the banks because they've been essentially suppressing interest rates artificially.
Are there any laws that apply to that?
Oh yeah, absolutely. They're being investigated all over the world for having done this. This is classic cartel activity. You know, it's like the movie The Informant, where they fixed the price of lysine, you know, that food additive. But this dwarfs any kind of price fixing cartel activity that has ever existed, ever, because LIBOR affects about $400 trillion worth of investments. So this is maybe the biggest crime in history.
And you also mentioned robo-signing earlier. Was Bank of America one of the pioneers in that practice?
Absolutely. Absolutely. What is robo-signing? Robo-signing essentially means that when the banks acquired all these mortgages, they're supposed to do things like keep the paperwork, and when they sell and resell these mortgages, they're supposed to go to the individual municipalities and register the transfer of the deed and pay fees and fines. Well, the banks didn't want to deal with any of that because once they made their money selling the phony mortgages, why bother keeping it up? So they just didn't do any paperwork. But except when they had to foreclose on somebody, suddenly they needed paperwork. So what did they do? They just had whole departments full of these entry-level employees, essentially, forging court documents. And that's what robo-signing is.
That's illegal, isn't it?
Of course it's illegal. It's massively illegal.
B of A was also involved in a scandal to collect fees from prepaid debit cards given to unemployment benefit recipients. How did that work?
Yeah, in some states, I think it was South Carolina was the state I was talking about, where the Bank of America has a contract to deliver unemployment insurance benefits, and people get they get little Bank of America prepaid debit cards to collect their unemployment insurance benefits. But it turned out that if they didn't go to a Bank of America ATM machine, they could pay fees as high as $10 as a penalty. So that, I'm sure that's not what the state had in mind when they enacted that program.
The Federal Reserve allowed Bank of America to move a huge portfolio worth $5 trillion to the to the side of the company that is FDIC insured. Why was that decision made? Just to protect it?
Yeah, actually, frighteningly enough, this is a relatively common practice in banking. What is striking is that this was Bank of America. This company was in real trouble when this happened last year. Essentially, Bank of America was sitting on top of trillions of dollars of very dangerous derivative instruments because of their acquisition of Merrill Lynch. And some of their business partners and their what you call counterparties were nervous about all that stuff. And so they asked Bank of America to move it from Merrill Lynch to its own depository side because that was FDIC insured and that would help allay some of the losses if they blew up. And so they did. They moved a couple of trillion dollars worth of this stuff and now we're on the hook for it if it blows up.
We have very little time left, so we can't get to all the other things that you've listed. Anything that stands out that we haven't talked about?
Well, there's municipal bid rigging is another thing. That's what I'm working on right now, and that's another massive scandal that Bank of America was involved in.
And they don't pay taxes.
No, they didn't pay. They paid no taxes last year and no taxes the year
before. But gave out big bonuses to their top management.
Right. They said they had $5 billion in pre-tax losses, so they couldn't pay any taxes, but they paid out over $30 billion in bonuses.
Has the bad publicity hurt them?
Yes, definitely. I mean, their share price went down to $5 last year, which was very nearly the death knell for the company. But they're up to 10 again, and actually some analysts are saying they might go up to 20. So they've survived. Even after all of this, they've survived, and they continue to get government support, and that's why they're still in business.
Well, there has been a call to break up some of the big banks. Mm-hmm. Is that likely to happen?
No, it's not likely to happen, but it's increasingly a mainstream thing to ask for that. The head of the Dallas Fed just issued a report last week essentially saying we got to break up these companies, but it'll be a while before mainstream politicians come around to realizing that, I think.
Well, since Bank of America seems to be liable in so many fronts, could they be bankrupted just simply by all of the lawsuits?
Absolutely. And minus continual government support,
they would
go out of business organically if we just simply cut off the tab. You know, they're able to go to the Fed right now and get unlimited sums of money from the Fed for nothing, no interest, and that's what's keeping them alive.
So who do I call?
your congressman, you know, anybody, and move your money out of Bank of America.
Matt Taibbi of Rolling Stone, his latest article, Bank of America, Too Crooked to Fail, is in the April issue. And I want to thank you so much for being here for today's Backstory segment.
Thanks so much, Leonard.